Good morning, everybody. I have to admit, this is very intimidating. And of course, about 90% of my jokes were just deleted. Okay. Now, seriously, I hope, despite the austerity of this setting here, that we can have a little bit of an informal discussion as well. I forgot the title, but I think the title of this talk is Managing Anger. I know that's the general topic. I forgot. Or Managing Anger in Your Children? Is that it? Okay, good. So what I'm going to be doing is, and we're talking about some generalities about the whole issue of anger. Again, to follow up on the theme, if some of you are repeat offenders and you were at my sibling rivalry presentation, the goal of childhood, I mean, childhood is a dress rehearsal for adulthood. The goal of childhood is to prepare kids for being adults. That's our function. So anything we do, as I said many times downstairs, anything we do, or if we have a decision to make, whether it has to do with anger, jealousy, sibling relationships, we have to fast forward to adulthood and figure out the comparable situation in adulthood, and then see how we'd like, what skills we want the child to have. So the same thing is true with anger. So I'm going to talk some generalities about anger, managing anger. I'm going to trace the different types of manifestations of anger you're going to have at different ages, because it's a very different kettle of fish, depending what age child you have. And then some, I'd like to conclude with some of the less typical situations which some of you might be facing. Okay? The main point, and I think this is, keep in mind, again, we have to understand what our goal is. The main point with anger is that anger, like I said, of sibling rivalry, is in and of itself is not a bad thing. We need, God created in us a capacity to be angry. And it serves a function. And we just do enough, again, I'm standing in front of the Aron Kodesh, so I'll try to wax a little rabbinic, but we only have to look in the Chumash, and how many times Hashem got angry, and how many times Moshe got angry, and different people at different times, different, you know, important people who are supposed to be role models for us, got angry. So anger has its place. The key point is, and it's really, it's human nature. Animals get angry. I mean, it's really human nature to be angry. The key difference is that whether you control the anger or whether the anger controls you. The goal ultimately is, and I think that would be something that we would all have to consider as well, if we get angry as adults, and I'm assuming we're all functioning, well-adjusted, well-adapted adults, if we get angry at a child, if we get angry at a spouse, we get angry at a parent, we get angry at a co-worker, at a friend or something like that, that we use the anger constructively. If we have control over it and we say, why am I angry? How can I correct whatever is troubling me? Is it legitimate? In other words, if we do a sort of a drisha v'chakira, we explore ourselves, and we channel the anger in a positive way, then anger can be very constructive. If we let it take over, if we let it consume us and we act irrationally, etc., then the anger is destructive. Sometimes with kids who have anger problems, I'll compare it, or for that matter, it could be taiva issues. But when I'm working with kids, I'll compare it to fire. Fire is a wonderful thing. Fire heats our homes, it cooks our food. God forbid, fire that's not under control can burn and can harm and can do tremendous damage. So the same thing is true with these kind of impulsive types of things, that managed and controlled and used constructively, it's positive. And that's what we want to teach our children, how to be comfortable with their anger, how to recognize it, which is a very important point I'm going to get to later, being a roes hanolad, to see the anger coming and to use it constructively, it can be something positive. If it consumes us, if it controls us, then it's dangerous. I'll give two very discrepant examples. I was actually thinking about it as we were driving here. Maybe I'm dating myself a little bit, but I used to like Star Trek, the Star Trek show a lot. And there was one Star Trek show. Again, you can learn from everything. There was one show where Kirk is being transformed. I have to tell one story. Okay, one funny story. I had a colleague of mine who had a placement in Creedmoor, which is a state hospital. And again, we'll see who gets this joke. But anyway, he had a patient who was psychotic, and he was out of control. And that time, we're talking about a long time ago, they didn't have a lot of the things they have today. They used to give patients cold baths. And the cold bath would shock them and would calm them down. So they were giving this guy a cold bath, and the whole time he's screaming, I have to have my wallet, give me my wallet, I have to have my wallet. Everybody was ignoring him, and he was a young guy, idealist, and he said, guy wants his wallet, let him have his wallet. And he's arguing with the nurses, and finally went to the unit chief, who had just arrived from Bahrain or something like that, barely spoke English, and said, you know, they want, he wants his wallet. Let him have his wallet. So my classmate, feeling very self-righteous and, you know, and sanctimonious, walks into the patient's room with the nurses, finds the wallet. I need my wallet for this. And he walks in, there's a kid, the guy in the patient in the bath, and he's screaming and shocking, splashing. And he said, here, Mr. Smith, here's your wallet. And he flips around and says, Spock, this is Kirk, beam me up. So, at any rate, so those see, now we see who gets it. Watch TV when they were kids. Okay. At any rate, so Kirk is being beamed up, and his personality gets split in two, and there are two Kirks. And one's the bad Kirk, who's doing all these bad things. And one's the good Kirk, who's kind and gentle. But the interesting thing was, the good Kirk couldn't command the ship. And the Klingons were attacking, and he couldn't fight back. He needed his bad side. He needed his anger to be a leader. And they had to bring them, merge them two of them together, and then he was able to lead the ship. L'havdil elef alfei havdalos, the Gemara basically says the same. The Gemara says that if you have a tendency to be a murderer, become a shaychet. You take what you have, these, and you use them constructively. And that's the important difference. So let's talk about different ages and how anger manifests itself. Let me start with what's probably the easiest, and that's babies. Babies get angry. Or even, let's say, before even young toddlers. They get angry. But they get angry, again, it's a natural impulse, but they get angry when they're frustrated. If the food doesn't come quick enough, if the, you know, there's a diaper rash and you're diapering them, or whatever, or if they want a toy and you take it away from them, you know, or they, you know, they want to, you know, take their wet finger and stick it into the outlet and you tell them no, they're frustrated and they're angry. And they'll get upset and they'll get angry, but the moment you pick them up and you calm them, whatever, it's over. They don't have, they're much more responsive to the immediate situation. So the anger is really just a response to a situation, and then they calm down. Different babies have different temperaments. We're going to get into that later, because so do older children. So some shriek and cry, and some just kind of whimper. That's inbred. Nothing to do with how you're handling them, or very little probably to do with how you're handling them. And they get over it. There's not a retention. They reach a certain age, usually around two, where suddenly there's new concepts to them. They now understand, the baby, even though they get frustrated, really believes that they have control over everything. And they don't have a sense of danger. That's why, you know, you have to be very careful because a kid will walk right into the street. They don't have a sense. They feel like they're always with the mother, that they're always protected. At around age two, the whole idea of frustration and a retention of frustration, in other words, they now understand that this is part of life, that they don't get everything they want, that there are potential dangers. You know, the classic toddler is the one who's playing the playground, and suddenly, you know, they call in psychology refueling. Suddenly realize the mother's not there and come running back to the mother. So now they have an understanding that there are things in life they don't have. They understand that things don't always go their way. It's a new concept to them. So the so-called terrible twos that last till about 22. That's why it's called terrible twos, because it goes from 2 to 22. The terrible twos is really, again, a normal stage where the child suddenly realizes that they things are frustrating, things don't always have their way. There's anger, there's things they want they can't get. Their rules, this is all brand new to them. They don't have and they understand it now, so they're frustrated. But you have a natural age where they have outbursts and tantrums. Now, this is the age where most of the anger is going to take place between the child and the parent. More so, in fact, even than caretakers. It's the classic thing, right? Your kid's having outbursts every, you know, 20 minutes or so. They're getting up constantly at night and waking you up in the middle of the night. You're wiped out. So your parents say, I'll take them for a few days, right? Take child for a day, and he's an absolute angel. The moment he comes home, right back where they started from. It's usually, again, because the parents are the ones who are supposed to make the world perfect. The parents are the main protectors. So much of this frustration and anger is displaced onto the parents. So here's an age where you have much more of this parent-child kind of outbursts and tantrums. It can spread into elementary school age children as well, or at that age as well. But it's more typical for the relatively younger child, let's say from 2 to about 6 or 7. Now, again, the classic manifestation of this kind of anger at this age is the tantrum. And more, there are kids today that have outbursts and have uncontrollable tantrums. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit. It might not be every child, but there are more and more kids that will have outbursts and really lose control. Will really throw things, shriek, scream, attack, and are literally out of control. And how to handle that. And basically, again, to get back to what I said earlier, the rule of thumb with these kind of outbursts is to teach the child, and again, it's not going to come naturally, but to teach the child to be a roes hanolad, to recognize it and to deal with it. First of all, you never intervene when the kid is beyond that threshold. When the kid is in the throes of a rip-roaring tantrum, they can't hear, they can't reason. That's true of older children, too, if they have those kind of tantrums. True of husbands as well, if they have those kind of tantrums. Not wives, obviously. But, you know, I'm picking on the men today, right? But, you know, but generally speaking, this is the age when it happens. And to try to punish reason with a child when they're tearing apart their room or when they're scratching, screaming, yelling, and shrieking is, as they say in Latin, a teutenbanken. So the point, so that you never intervene at that point. The interventions when you're dealing with tantrums are before the tantrum and after the tantrum. Now, before the tantrum, if your child has repeated tantrums, one of the things you have to do is you have to give it a name. You have to name the monster. And I mean that literally. You have to have something to call these tantrums. Because, again, the child doesn't know what it is. Again, a child just experiences things. They don't necessarily identify it. If you want to deal with it, you have to give it a boundary, if you will. You have to call it something. And you can call it anything. You can call it Henry. You can call it Cass. You can call it outburst. You can have a code, because sometimes if you're dealing with this, you don't want the other siblings to know because they'll tease you. So you can give it a number. You can call it six or something like that. But the first thing you do is you identify it for the kid. That when you get like this, and you know what I'm talking about, when you're screaming and you're shrieking and you're breaking things and you're kicking and you take off your shoes and you throw it, whatever it is, that's called Cass. We're going to call that six. We're going to call it John. Okay? Now we have a name for it. And the reason for that is you want to teach the child to recognize it when it's about to happen, not when it's reached that point when they can't control it anymore. So if a kid is frustrated, and a kid is now starting, and you can sense, you know, they're getting heavy, they're starting to cry, they're starting to lose it. At that point, you want to say to the child, watch out, John's coming. Watch out, Mr. Cass is coming. Some of the kids have a little hard, the older kids don't like it because they think you like teasing them, but the younger kids can relate to that. And you want to teach them at that juncture to contain it and control it. And that point, and you can give them, because again, they're having problems with tantrums, you can give them things to do. You know, we're going to get back to this later. We'll go outside, go on your bike and ride your bike. Why don't you go to the bathroom and throw some water on your face? Okay? Or why don't you go listen to your tape? Listen to some music, and when you don't think John's coming anymore, we're going to continue this conversation. We're not going to drop it. We're going to continue this. We're going to get back to it. But to help them try to control it before it happens. And if you're going to reward, and you know, we talk about reward and punishment. If you're going to reward, you reward for that self-restraint. You reward for that ability to control themselves and prevent it from coming on. Again, let's fast forward to adulthood, right? You know that this certain behavior that your boss does, that when your boss barks at you, you want to wring his neck. You know it. And you know that if you stay with it, you're going to wring his neck and you're going to lose your job, right? That's the point. We all do this. That's the point. Where you call your wife and you moan and groan about him, right? Well, that's the point where you go to the bathroom and you draw a little picture of him and you throw darts at it. Whatever you do, you know, you do things to control yourself. We all do that, you know. There's that famous story. I forget who it is, but one of them, Gudel, had an angry coat, and every time he would only get angry if he had that coat. And when he got angry at something, he'd run and get. By the time he got the coat on, he wasn't angry anymore. You know, that's, you know, so you have to recognize it coming on and contain it and control it. And that's, you learn to do that because you were taught, again, to anticipate the so-called tantrum and then contain it. If the child steps into that boundary, again, this is more typical for the younger children, and they're in, you know, they're out of control. If you have some place where they can go, I mean, you know, usually it's their room. Let them have it out in their room. And I mean, in severe cases, and again, we're not talking about the typical ones, sometimes parents actually build a timeout room where they can go and have a tantrum, which, you know, padded walls and, how do we decorate mine? You know, where they can have pillows and punching bags and things to get it all out. But, you know, most of us, again, with the more typical kids, we don't have that. So they go to their room. Please don't worry about possessions. They may trash out their room. It's not the biggest deal in the world. Sometimes, and really sometimes, you have to literally hold the door. I don't like locking doors. I don't like locking kids in a room. It's a scary thing for a kid. But you may have to stand between them and the door and let them have their tantrum. It doesn't last forever. It does, but in the tantrum, you don't do anything. You just, or you can, or you hold them. You hold them, not hold them to, can we wait till the end and we'll take questions? Okay, thanks. Hold them just so they don't hurt or hurt themselves or something, if it's very extreme. When the tantrum's over, that's when you talk. You see? Mr. Kaz came again. We got to do something. Got to make sure he doesn't come anymore. Next time. Or if you want to say, you know, even if you feel that it's something that you want to teach them through some punishment, you know, today you can't go out and play in the playground because you let Mr. Kaz come in. All right, but to talk to them then when they're in the throes of a tantrum doesn't do any good. A few other tricks with a trade which probably would apply to all ages, okay? Teach as much as possible for the child to verbalize what they're angry about. Because there is an antagonistic relationship between verbalizing and acting. If you say it, you're much less likely to act on it. So if a child is very physical or is having an outburst, and the outburst is taking physical forms, if they say it with words, tell me what you're upset about, tell me what you're angry about, learn, again, which is something that we do. It's all basically ventilating. So when, as I said, an example before, when your boss antagonized you and you call home and you call your wife and you're blah, 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 and you talk it out, you're already feeling better. You're less angry. Because the verbalizations are in part of the brain where there's more control. Anger is more of an emotional type of, controlled by the more emotional part of the brain, and you're more likely to act and do something without thinking. So once you put it into words, so teach the children at young ages to express, again, once they have those words, give them the words. All right, tell me, you're angry, you're upset, you're frustrated, and give them the words. Now tell me about it, talk to me about it, draw a picture about it, let's say, you know, or something like that. Then it becomes, then again, you're teaching them skills in life to cope with anger. Teach them patience, like the story I told you with the anger coat. The research even shows that people are not capable physiologically to stay in that kind of excited state for long. And sometimes, you know, it's a whole counting to 10. That if you wait, if you know you're too angry, and you wait, then the anger dissipates on its own. And to teach a child, you know what, when you're this angry, we can't talk. We will talk. You can even, if they tell time already, you know, it's 10:20. At 10:30, we're going to talk, but till 10:30, we have to calm down, okay? And maybe if you want, you can practice them. Let's do some calming down things, okay? Let's sing a song. Let's take a walk, and then we'll talk. So now you're teaching them some, besides, let's say, you know, finding some other kind of outlets, but also teaching them that even waiting, just being patient, dissipates anger. Another thing that's very important, and again, this applies to every age, so maybe I'm being a little disorganized at this point, but children need outlets. And besides, not even with anger, but in general, they should have in their repertoire of behavior things that are outlets, that get things out of their system so that they don't necessarily have to act on anger, or they have an outlet when they are angry. Sports is a very good one. And sports doesn't mean necessarily has to be an organized hockey game. Riding a bike, jumping rope, shooting hoops, and I will tell you, and again, I'm not interested in spending other people's money. You know, the old definition of a Zionist is Reuven telling Shimon to make Aliyah with Levi's money. You know, I don't believe in spending other people's money, but you should have available in your home things that are natural outlets, whether it's music, whether it's someplace they can dance, But a kid should have it, and in general, besides for one's, you know, physical health, but it's also a very good way for the kids to get out of the system. And by the way, it's not a topic of conversation, but needs to be addressed in many ways as well. For the teenagers, and particularly teenage boys, it's a very good way for them to control themselves with their desires, which is a very hard thing for yeshiva boys to do nowadays. But if they can run themselves ragged on a basketball court, once in a while, you know, and Baruch Hashem, our schools today have basketball courts and have opportunities for that. It does help with that, but certainly with anger as well. They should have availability of outlets. And I'm going to say something that's going to sound very unpsychological, but it is psychological. Teach them mussar. Teach them values. Teach them the value of controlling yourself or of gaining mastery over your anger. So show them in the Chumash. Tell them stories like the one I just told, because the psychological research shows that religious beliefs, religious practices are enormously helpful in promoting mental health and in exercising restraint. So there's nothing, again, I'm not talking about, it's not my position to speak like a Rav, But psychologically, the having in their, in their repertoire, in their armamentarium, some chazal and some sources and even models or stories of proper restraint, of proper use of anger. I mean, there's many stories. You hear stories even of poskim that sometimes would get angry. People ask them shilas because they were being manipulated. There was appropriate use of anger. Is useful to have and will help the help children all along. One other question that comes up a lot, and I'm going to address it now, and then I'll talk a little bit more about elementary school age children and teenagers, time permitting. What about kibbut of a, or even kavod habrios? Kid is angry and says something nasty to a parent. A kid is legitimately angry about something that was done to him and uses nivel peh, or something like that. You know, how do we handle that? And in that case, again, we're talking now probably a little bit of an older child. It really becomes important to differentiate the two situations. That, because you could say on the one hand, let's say a kid is very angry, some big kid started up with him and beat him up or something, typical boy kind of stuff, and he comes home and he's angry, and he's right to be angry. And it's okay to be angry, because again, anger motivates us to do something. But he's using some very choice words, you know? Keep the two issues separate. Because otherwise there'll be a confusion. You're very right to be angry, and you're very right to be frustrated. That's not how we express it. Or, I understand, it's okay to be even angry, and again, it depends how you hope, but it's okay to be angry at mommy and daddy. We just told you that you can't have something you really want very badly. And that's okay to be angry, but you can't be fresh. You can't be disrespectful. Those are two separate issues. And if you have to intervene, and if you have to punish, or you have to do something, say, I'm punishing you not for being angry, I'm being punishing for you for how you were angry. So don't feel, you can go to either extreme. You can get very angry about how they express their anger, and they're going to think it's wrong to be angry. They're being punished for being angry for their feeling, which is wrong. Or you can go to the other extreme and say, well, Nebuch, he's the right to be angry, so I'll allow him to be disrespectful, allow him to express the anger in inappropriate ways. No, you can differentiate the two, but you have to, especially when somebody is very emotional, you have to keep the two very separate. Now, when you get to elementary school age, and again, I jumped around a little bit. Forgive me. I think my Ritalin's wearing off. But when you get to elementary school age children, very often the aggression is expressed between the peers. It shifts very often, though the anger expressed shifts very much because their lives shift. For the preschool age child, their home is really the arena where much happens. Once they get to school and they're spending the bulk of their day in school and camp, etc., then most of what's happening now is happening between peers. And you're going to get a lot more of this kind of aggression problems or anger problems being worked out, being expressed or being acted out, if you will, between the peers. And a common situation which a lot of parents struggle with is, what do you do? Your kid gets into a fight. What happens when your kid is picked on? What happens when they're taunted? There's a lot of that going on, even with the best kids in the best schools, where kids get picked on, kids get called names. I mean, the absolute worst thing. I mean, there's certain experiences that you should never have to witness. For a while, I was a psychologist in school where my kids went to that school, and that's a tremendous nisayon. Because there are two things one should never see. I always say that. One is something called recess, which is really al nisecha shebechol yomana. Sometimes in psychology, I have to observe a kid has social problems. I observe a kid during recess. And it's amazing. Bodies are falling. Balls are flying. People are getting knocked over. Then the principal blows a whistle and they all come back in one piece. It's really mamish and ace, The other thing you should never have to see, I really am serious, is something called dismissal. It's the scariest thing in the world. Our school's planned her, like 1,500 kids in. You have 150 identical yellow buses lined up in front of the school, with identical looking bus drivers. They're all named Greg, and somehow or another these 1,500 kids get home. It's the scariest thing. It really is. But also another scary thing is that bus ride home. What goes on those buses, if you've ever been driving behind one of them, it is really, it's okay corral in there. But you'll have fights picked on, all kind of things happening there. So, first of all, again, maybe I'm addressing a little bit more the boys, but an interesting thing, by the way, is that the gender boundaries with time are getting more and more blurred. So a lot of things that used to be more exclusively boys is now boys and girls. But you get a lot of aggression, you get a lot of fighting with boys at this age. Now, there are two approaches to it. To some extent, you can say this is normal. And it is to some extent normal. Boys will fight, and boys will get physical, girls now more and more so. Will hit, will punch, will push, etc. In normal circumstances, they just know how far to go. It's an interesting thing. Again, when I used to observe that horrible thing called recess, sometimes I would see kids get into fights. And if you watch it, it never gets too far. There's a little pushing, even some hitting. Once one got the upper hand, the other one sort of backs off, and 5 minutes later, they're friends again. You know, there's a little bit in the culture, some room for some of that physicality. Of course, the kids with problems go too far, or a kid, maybe a professional victim, gets picked on too much. But in the normal circumstances, that's to some extent tolerant. Now, some schools will kind of look the other way for that norm. They'll just break it up, and they'll tell them to go back to recess or something like that. Some schools have now, I'm hearing more and more, and I can see the legitimacy of it as like a zero tolerance for any even play fighting. And I even remember one of my kids, not so long ago, when I was in eighth grade, I got a call, he's suspended, I have to come pick him up for fighting. And I picked him up, I said, what happened? I said, who do you have a fight with? You know, Ellie, your best friend, what happened? He said, I don't know myself. He said, we had cardboard, we fashioned two swords out of cardboard, and we were having a sword fight. And so I called the principal. I said, it must have been misunderstanding, because they were having fun. They weren't angry, they were having fun. I called the principal. He said, no, we have a zero tolerance. He said, even for play fighting. Because the play fighting sometimes deteriorates into real fighting, or sometimes even play fighting, kids get hurt. They play wrestle and they hurt each other. So I didn't realize, but okay, but you know, so some schools have this kind of zero tolerance. But if they don't, or if it's in the playground, or if it's in your backyard, there is a little bit of this in the culture. And again, there's a difference between some of the out of control aggression, some of the normal, as I said, pushing, shoving, hitting a little bit, which does occur. Now, what happens if your child is taunted? What happens if your child is picked on? Okay, what happens if your child comes home and says, all the kids say this and this, all the kids call me this name. Kids are picking me, they're leaving me out. This is the norm, this stuff happens. And if your kid is the victim, first let me tell you what not to do. Okay? Please don't turn to the kid and in a very angry voice scream to them, well, you have to stop paying attention to them, or you have to stand up for yourself and start reprimanding them. I know it hurts to know your child. Again, it's one of the signs of being a parent is that so much of what happens to your child is away from, is not under your control. But if you picture this kid coming home demoralized, upset because they've been excluded from the game, they think they have no friends, or they've been picked on, or a bunch of kids have called the names or started up with them, and now they come home and mommy and daddy are upset at them as well. So that's the last thing you do. What I would recommend in these kind of situations, and this might sound a little hard to hear, but I'll explain it to you, is first of all, when they first come in, a hug, some hot chocolate, a little bit of a treat, you know, let them lick their wounds, and then, in a way, put down the other children. What do I mean? Okay. In other words, they say they made fun of my red hair, and they're such beauties. And what about Esther? You know, she has freckles, and what about Sarah? She has that curly hair. What makes them so? What do you think about that? They're so beautiful. Or they were pushing me around. Oh, they're big shots. When there's three of them, they'll push you around. I bet you if you had your brothers there, they wouldn't be pushing you around. What am I doing? Okay? I'm accomplishing two things. First of all, I'm giving them an attempt for nekama. Even if it's not real nekama, they're getting even a little bit. They feel victimized. If they have a chance to sort of get back, even if it's in fantasy, now they feel a little better. They feel empowered. I'm also giving them what I want them to do in those circumstances. Because we all know what's the best antidote to being picked on, to being bullied, is not, you don't run away, because that just encourages more bullying. You don't try to fight back, because anyone who bullies usually does it, either if they're twice your size, or they have 3-4 people behind them. So I'm giving them what is really what I want them to do, which is to brush it off and not take it seriously. To not, you know, not let it get to them. Not to have that victimized look in their face, not to try to, you know, handle a situation which is beyond their control. So I'm not telling them, because then I'm criticizing them and they're already demoralized, but I'm having fun with them and I'm giving them sort of a method or a repertoire of something to respond. Now, sometimes people get angry at me when I say that. I say, well, now you're teaching the kid to put other people down. But that's what we do. Again, go back to the boss situation, right? Your boss chews you out for something you don't deserve. What do? You know, you come home that night, you make fun of him. You know, the big guy's got that big belly, and you know, look, you know, he's got an ugly wife, you know, or whatever. You know, you put him down, all right? Or you have a fantasy of what's going to happen to him. You know, someday I'm going to be a bigger boss, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to get even with him. You know, and all that. And by the time you're the bigger boss, he's long forgotten it. But this is what we do. This is an adaptive way of handling frustrating situations when we've been taunted, when we've been picked on, and it gives the kid that opportunity. Okay, now. Okay, let me talk a little bit about adolescence and one or two other points, and then we maybe have some time for a little bit of a give and take, okay? With adolescence, it's a funny thing what happens with anger is that, as I said, the preschool-aged child much of the anger is directed towards the parents. During elementary school age, it gets shifted to the school. The adolescent brings it back home. But the adolescent anger is a very different kind of anger. The adolescent anger very often is, again, under normal circumstances, is some of that normal adolescent rebellion. And again, this is all typical and normal. The adolescent rebellion, without going, again, it's not the topic, I'm sure you're all familiar, basically is the adolescent's attempt to assert his individuality. We all have a basic human need to be distinct individuals. It's an inherent need. In fact, no better proof than settings that want to torture you will take away your individuality, whether it's prisons or concentration camps or Beis Yaakov. No, I'm sorry. But they make you wear uniforms. They take away your individuality. We have a and in fact, if you've read some of the literature of people who have been in POW camps like that, they sometimes risk their lives to assert a certain individuality, to maintain their sense of who they are. So the teen is at that age when they're trying to assert their individuality. So a lot of that very provocative behavior, a lot of that very in-your-face rebellious behavior is normal adolescence. And again, the role of the parent is not to try to squelch that. The role of the parent is to try to give it appropriate expression. In other words, it's fine that you disagree. It's fine that you have a different opinion. There's a way to express it. Or you're overdoing it now. Or allow a certain amount. Okay, fine. You want to wear this and this shirt or this and this dress, and it's not my first choice. I'll allow that, but not this. That's a bit too far. But to acknowledge it, because really the expression is not as much anger as much as the typical adolescent attempt to express themselves and find some sort of expression. Sometimes you will get, the teens will form groups. You'll have gangs, you'll have cliques, and a lot of this anger gets expressed that way with the sort of teen contagion. And again, it's usually very much, I don't go into it, it's really more teenager stuff, but that's more typical for behavior for that age. One or two other points, and then we can have a little bit of give and take. I hope it goes without saying that if you want your children to learn how to control their anger, how to express their anger appropriately, you must model it. Don't scream and yell at your child about screaming and yelling. Or if they see high conflict situations in the home, whatever kind of situations they are, or for that matter, if you're sitting at the table ranting and raving about how much you hate the rabbi, you're not giving them a very good model of controlling your anger, etc. The other thing is also, there are inherent constitutional factors, and this becomes important as well. Just like we all have different physical attributes, just like we have different faces and different colored hair and eyes, etc., we are born inherently with different temperaments. Some people are born with a calmer, more controlled temperament. Some are born with a more excitable temperament. All you have to do is ask anyone who's been a nurse in a nursery. Newborn babies come out. They cry differently. I'm sure that probably the mothers in particular know. Each pregnancy, every kid is different. Some are like, kicking you like crazy, and others seem like they're sitting there, smoking something that they shouldn't. Everybody has a different, it's built in. So there are people that by nature are more excitable. There are people who are by nature have a much harder time controlling themselves. That's not an excuse. Again, we believe, certainly as Torah-observant Jews, we believe that you don't just give in to all your natures. If you have a more excitable nature, then the onus or responsibility on you is to control it better. That's, so it's not used as a suit, but it's something to recognize and to realize that it's not necessarily your parenting or something that's necessarily happened to the child, but that kids are different. Again, your typical ADHD kid or whatever, if those of you don't know what ADD is, it's what's afflicting most of you now while I'm talking. It's an inability to pay attention and sit still and, but I'm saying those are going to be kids that are going to be more explosive and have more outbursts. Okay. The other thing is, let me just see if there's, oh yeah. Especially, and this should be in general, but especially if your kid is having problems with self-control, with anger. TV, movies, even some of the music is bad for them. And it doesn't get enough publicity for the very simple reason that the people that are supposed to make publicity are the ones who own the TV stations. They're not publicizing. But the research, just to give you an idea in terms of violence, there are studies that are, what you call, I'm blocking the word, but, studies where you see, any statisticians here, when two things go together? I'm blocking now. Huh? Causal relation, right. In other words, two things. In other words, let's say, you know, we know that, for example, if you eat a lot of those Danishes out there, you're going to get fat. And if I want to do a study, I can do a study and show that eating a lot of Danishes may, you know, have something to do with obesity, because there's a tendency, you know, they go together. In health, the most compelling study in terms of these kind of relationships is smoking and lung disease. You know what's the second most compelling study? TV watching and violence. It is overwhelming. And, again, I'm probably speaking to a community that has very little exposure to this or more limited, but again, especially if a child is having a problem with anger or self-control, some of these shows, some of these movies, even the news items, by the way, you have to be careful because they get sensationalized, they promote violence, they idealize it, and you really have to filter, and if a kid does have exposure, even the music, by the way, some of these fast-paced, and the music style has crept into our music as well. Some of our Jewish music has a very intense rock-like quality to it. That'll get a kid revved up. And if the child has some exposure to it, let's say they see something, let's say, you know, they tell the story, I know it's an extreme example, but they tell the story of Akiva Agus, who used to say that when he was a young kid, he was once walking with his mother, and two guys had a fight, broke out in the fight. His mother saw it, she covered his eyes. And he would say, as an older man, how much better person he'd be if he hadn't witnessed that. You can imagine, Pete, what we witness and what we see and what we read about in the paper. If they are exposed, especially a kid who already has problems with self-control and anger, filter it, explain it to them, let them process it. Don't just let it go. One more last thing. This may be more true of younger children, but children are not always precise with their responses. And sometimes, you know, we more likely respond in a fashion that reflects our feelings. When we're angry, we scream, or we get aggressive, when we're sad, we cry, we're scared, we shudder. Children sometimes, you know, are not that precise, so they'll feel uchi. So an angry kid will cry, or an unhappy child will attack, and especially with the younger children. So sometimes if you see outbursts or anger, etc., especially if it hadn't existed before, if it's a sudden change, it could be that something's troubling them. It could be something that's bothering them, but they don't necessarily express it directly. So it comes out imprecisely, and it's something then to look into. We have about 10 minutes, so let me go ahead. Yeah. A normal child. If a child doesn't want to hear you, of course they don't want to hear you. You know, you want to hear your mother? Especially when she was reprimanding and correcting your behavior? You know, there was a very famous psychiatrist, Harry Stack Sullivan. He was the founder of the American School of Psychiatry. He used to talk about therapy, but I think we could say about kids too. He used to say that the patients come to therapy for two reasons. One is to change, the other is to stay the same. You know, nobody wants to change. No one wants to correct the behavior. No one wants to have that pressure on them. So of course the kid doesn't want to listen. The only thing I could tell you is, first of all, maybe he's still, you know, sometimes what I do, in fact, I should have mentioned this. I'll get back to this, important to this. Sometimes what I do when I'm working with a kid, let's say we're dealing anger control or something like that, I teach the kid to have an internal barometer. And I'll say to them, this is from 1 to 10. 1 to 3 means you're chill. 7 to 10 means you're out of control. 4 to 7 means you're in the middle. And then I'll go over situations and what are you then? When this happens, what are you? Are you this? Are you 4? Are you 7? And then to teach them to learn to monitor themselves. So the 4 to 7 is the crucial period. That's where I want to get them. So then the mother can say, again, unless the siblings are around, because it's embarrassing, but let's say the siblings aren't around. Where are you now? You know? Are you 4 or 5? You know? Are you an 11? You know? So if the kid won't listen, if I look at that barometer, they may not be in a 7 yet, but I might be 6 3/4, you know? And then I may need to calm them down. Something that works again if it's a younger child is tactile stuff. Is hold them, and not hold them, rub the back, hold them by the arms, I want to talk, take a few deep breaths, calm them down. But they should absolutely not want to listen to you. That's normal. Anytime. You know, when you tell them not to have ice cream before supper, they don't want to listen to you. That's you know, what was it? That comedian once said everybody's upset their kids don't listen to them. He said, look at God. Adam and Eve didn't listen to them either, you know. So, you know, it's built into the nature. Yeah. You go ahead. We have to speak up because I'm here in the altar. Yeah. All right, so here the question is, again, for people to take, is a kid who gets very angry, has prone towards, again, the temperamentally, and if he watches a video, it calms him down. Okay. I'm sorry? You're saying even though he was angry, but if he doesn't have it, he gets frustrated and gets angry. Okay. Now, I'm assuming the video is a calm, not one of these more high... I'm not even talking about violent. High to you, too. Okay. It's not one of these more violent... Huh? Let me address that. I don't want to spend too much time. If the video itself is a high-powered, intense video, the calm he may have is temporary, but later on it'll be more intense. In other words, it's the research seems to show that while kids are watching, and sometimes immediately afterwards, a show, even with violent content, I mean, you know, you see kids in front of the TV sets, right? They're mesmerized. Now, part of that reason for that is that the stimulation is so intense that the brain can't incorporate it all, so the brain sort of shuts down, because otherwise it wouldn't be able to tolerate it all. So there is a sort of pseudo-calm. It's a little bit like people who are, you know, drink a lot of alcohol think they're warm, feel warm, but they're not really warm. There are cases of people on the lower lane who freeze to death because they think they're warm, and they're not because of their inebriated state. So there's a fake calm, if you will, with watching these intense videos as well, which, after they finish the video and the brain can start responding again to normal levels of stimuli, they're more revved up. So you could have a situation where it's like that cycle where you're making it worse and worse. Let's say, though, the video is an Uncle Maishi, a very calm, easygoing video. If watching that or whatever calms him down, then you've just found an outlet for him. Then it's no different than playing ball or any of the other, or drawing pictures. Everybody has different outlets. Then again, if I fast forward to adulthood, if let's say he's responding to the music or something like that, this may be a person that when he finds it, he gets excited, he's got to put the iPod in his ear and listen to some music, and he's okay. That's fine. That's very adaptive. But you just got to be careful that you're not creating this vicious cycle where the video is actually making the anger more, and then he needs the video more, and you may be in that kind of vicious cycle. It depends on the video. I mean, I can't really comment beyond that. Okay. Any other questions, rebuttals? Go ahead. Yeah.
You touched upon teasing a little bit. Sure. But what about group teasing or like group bullying?
Right.
You know, as opposed to just dealing with one kid as a group.
Well, usually often the case. It's often the case. Group, we're talking about group bullying. Group. Again, bullying by definition means that somebody is taking advantage of their, if you will, dominant position. That's what bullying is. You're not going to have a 4'10" weakling bullying, you know, the captain of the football team. It just, you know, doesn't happen. So bullying by definition, so the bullying means that someone either has a position, they're in an advantageous position because of their size or intelligence or quickness of the mouth or something like that, or they have, you know, a gang behind them. You know, I mean, look, I remember as a kid going to school in a very bad neighborhood, and the local denizens used to start up with us, and it was always six of them and two of us. Never two of them and two of us. I mean, it was, you know, that's what bullies do, you know? So it's usually that's the case. Now, the best, again, I spoke earlier, the best antidote is not to care, is not to... Now, if it's really an epidemic, if you will, which happens sometimes, and especially as you get close to adolescence, and adolescence, as some of you may know, is starting earlier and earlier. I think it's only a matter of time before kids are going to be born adolescents, you know? But, you know, if it's endemic in the classroom, if it's something, a group phenomena, that different points, different gangs picking on different kids, it's really outside your arena then. I mean, there's very little you can do about that. There's ways to approach that from the school's perspective. And just, again, without going into this, really not your, the way the school has to deal with that is, and the mistakes the school sometimes make is to try to deal with it with the gang. In other words, if there are six, seven girls harassing different individual girls. So they try to deal with those 6-7 girls, and what they're doing paradoxically is they're making those 6-7 girls even stronger, because now they're identifying them more and more as a gang. So the way to approach it really usually is to break it up, and break it up by talk, dealing with each girl individually in the 6-7. And there's a whole science to it. But that's something that has to be done at the classroom level. At your level, you, as much as possible, instill an indifference in your child. And then try to promote other areas and other relationships which will be more satisfying and gratifying so that she doesn't define herself as a victim. But that's usually the best thing you do. And as I said, if it's really endemic in the classroom, maybe to bring it to the attention. First of all, if it's endemic in the classroom, you can be sure your daughter's not the only one who's being victimized. So it's a matter of, you know, finding the other victims and bringing it to the attention of the school. The school may not be, you know, a lot of this happens, recess, lunch, they may not be aware of it. Bring it to their attention and see if it can be addressed at that level. Yeah. I can hear you. I'm sorry. Huh? I'm not going to. That's. You don't have to. If you're not comfortable, don't do it. But to make her indifferent. And I don't mean put them down and say, "Ooh, she's disgusting. I hate her. I'm going to beat her up." You know. I mean, what to say? Well, mother, make them so pop. You know. Esther called me an idiot. Who's Esther? Esther, who's Esther? I think you're great, Mom. Think you're, everybody else thinks you're great. Who made Esther judge and jury? Not bad, but also, what I want her to do when Esther calls her a name next time is to look at her and say, "Who are you?" without saying it, but to think it. Then Esther's going to look for another victim, because the bullies look for the soft underbelly. And they're going to look for someone who's going to be reactive. So the kid whose eyes well up with tears, that's nice, you know? The kid who sort of rolls their eyes and goes on playing, they're not going to want to start up with them because they don't have the same, they don't get the same rise out of them. Yeah. Okay, great. How do you teach a child to stand up to bully? Tell them the rep. That's a very important point, by the way, because at many ages, depending on the age. I'm sorry. What are you, a kid's being bullied? How do you teach a child to stand up to the bully, and do you tell the Rebbe? Okay? Now, at many ages, certainly younger children, yeah, you tell the Rebbe. Because at that age, it's okay for the... Huh? Yeah, okay. So preschool and maybe first, second grade, the younger grades, it's okay to tell the Rebbe. As you get older, then you become a tattletale. And you can incur more wrath. And the sort of the childhood culture says, take care of yourself. Now, if it's out of control, first of all, any time an older child is starting with a younger child, then it's perfectly appropriate for the adult to intervene, because the older child, you know, you can't expect your child to handle someone older than him. So you want your child to be able to handle his contemporaries, but not an older child. Oh, one more rule of thumb, by the way, okay? Your neighbor down the block has a kid who is a budding criminal, okay? He's 6'4", you know, he's been smoking since he's 3. He's absolutely nasty, I'm all right? Don't call up the mother and say, "Your kid's terrible. Your kid's starting up with mine." Because no mother can see that, you know? I mean, it's you know, as far as she's concerned, he's the next Gadol Hador, you know? So you have to call another parent. The best approach is to say, "You know, look, our kids aren't getting along. I mean, I realize that your child is twice the weight of mine, and our kids are not getting along. Maybe we should tell each of our kids, I'm not saying it's your child's fault, my child's fault, maybe we should each tell our children to stay away from each other." It's a little safer way, because very hard, you know, you're dealing with somebody's child. It's a little more, okay. But again, okay, I'm wrapping up. This is the last thing. Okay. But there is an age where it can backfire if you go tattletaling, you know, or if the kids are starting with, gets called into the principal's office, you know, they're going to start up with you more. So the main thing to try to teach them is that kind of resilience, that kind of disregard. There might be points, so you might have to teach a kid to stand up for himself physically. Again, I know it's a hard thing, but to defend themselves, how to defend themselves physically is much, you know, you might have to. And then again, you're not teaching them to start up physically, but you're teaching them how to fend off an attack, not to prompt it. Okay, I'm around if anybody else has any questions or anything like that. Okay, thank you. Okay.